Hello, thank you for having me. So I'm going to play a quick selection of some music, mostly Irish or Irish inspired, that would have been popular around the time, a lot of it written around the time of 1916. So given the political and socio-economic state at the time, a lot of this music is quite dark in emotion, so unfortunately there won't be much foot tap or anything like that. I'm going to play the flute. This is an Irish flute. A lot of people ask questions, so I said I'd preempt them. It's made from African blackwood, so it's quite similar to the flute that you'd see played in orchestras, but has a slightly more mellow sound because of the material it's made from. So most of the music will be quite dark. There's something a little bit more lighthearted in the middle, just to show that life was going on. And I'm going to finish with a reel, something nice and quick, just to represent the culture that was ongoing throughout these troubling times and that has prevailed to our current day. So I hope that you enjoy it.
Thank you. Well, that's a great start. Now, the good news is this very talented lady is staying on, because they've had a chat amongst themselves, these lovely ladies, and they decided that. Are that good? You have to stay. So next up is Christine Murray, who lives in Dublin. She has published a number of volumes, including a small collection of cycles and interdependent poems in Lapwing Press 2013. She, a book-length single poem was published in 2014, and The Blind in 2013. She has published two chapbooks, Three Red Things with Smithereens Press in 2013, and Signature, Bowen Orchard Press, 2014. She is a curator of Poet Head, a poetry blog. She is about to become an essayist, and she's about to become our next guest. Please, another warm welcome for Christine.
Okay, this is about Countess Markovitch, and I'm just doing a brief introduction. Two of the leaders of the 1916 Rising had their death sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Even De Valera, because he was American, and Constance Markovitch, because she was a woman. Markovitch, sorry, thank you. Markovitch was sent to Aylesbury Prison in England to start her life sentence, and she was the first woman elected to the House of Commons. She never took her seat. Days of ecstasy, can you not live again, made for me, never dead, written by Constance Markovitch, Easter week 1917. They came to tell me, and they came to tell me that they would be shot. At each day's dawn, those others came to tell me they would shoot me. As a child, I knew how beyond the lamp circuit lay the shadow of the shadow of this darkness. I heard the cracking and I knew that my birds had flown. Willie Pierce, a carver in stone, was shot. His body melted into lime quickly. I do not know if it was the birds, that chaos of gulls and crows, that told me they shot James. The screeching stopped. And that silence before the cracking violence, and they came to tell me, each one, that they were to be shot. They did not come to see me off. I was sentenced to be shot, and I stood and I waited for the order to be carried out. They came to whisper their deaths, waiting with an arctic kiss in the well of the staircase, ready to drape the bed with visions no eyelids can vanquish. I waited for my death. No one came for me. I waited, listening for their songs, some indication or symbol of their escape, but none came. I saw Paddy leave through a side gate, his face clear blown away, his head bowed, and then he too was gone. I saw them injured and tied into chairs, guns cocked up. No person need tell me, for the birds told me, just as the blackbird strikes up his clear notes. They came to tell me in their proud uniforms, with their hearts all bloodied. They melted into the sun, melted through the bars. Days and days of ravening silences, and they're coming with them with their songs and their laments. They came to tell me that they were newly dead, and I was not, and I was. I waited for it to stop. I waited for them to come to me with a bit of paper, the order, a priest maybe. I wondered why I was not killed and why I was not let die. You came to sing to me with your warm feathers and your cheese of nesting. You came to sing to me soft-bosomed and warm, purring and burring in your new nests, your young cracking out of their eggs, stunned and begging for the sun. Hollowed by the silence of the eyes, the mind swings its clapper and life resolves into relationships of cadence and dissonance. Rise up and above the liffey, carrying your red blood to tell to the river. I would know without a word the shrieking of carrying fear, and I would not need to see your iron-riddled, rattle-punctured hearts to know that your sweet ghost had found the gate. I sat and knelt for 9 days of violence and woe. Birds told me, and yet I lived, I lived. I'm round with each pace I make, I feel the terror of your eyes upon me, and my heart speaks, my heart speaks that I live and yet I live, waiting with an arctic kiss in the well of the staircase, ready to drape the bed with visions no eyelids can vanquish. The cracking of guns, the carrying crows, the death furies wheeling, striving up, careening up above the silver streams of the Liffey, calling into the ears of any that would hear you called your deaths aloud. My comrades, brothers, I know that you have left, and not one of you took me beneath your endless sunlit wing. I know the meaning of fear, it is solitude. As a child, I knew how beyond the lamp circuit lay the shadow of this darkness. They would not treat me as a soldier, and they smuggled me to an enemy land, my tower of darkness. My grief swirled around it as the sea gyrates around the green rocks, the grey. Miles away, the sea pulls me, lashing its tumults, carrying those soaring birds in its streams and eddy. They call the found again, that none may flounder at your eyries and come. And oh, dead hearts, dead dreams, dead days of ecstasy. Can you not live again? Nay, for me, never dead. Recently, so I haven't had time to type it out, and I can't read my writing. So I'll give it a go. There are no mallards in the poem. This is the crossroads, this is where it is. Black cat killed a chaffinch. See the rusted feathers, feather blown, they roll down the steps, and your freedom. Even the robin hurls this. Someone has put bunting up. You are caught on the first step of your descent in a pause of red, of white, in this absolute now. I forgot to mention at the beginning, these poems are from a suite called A Transitory House, which is three poems, now four, and I just wrote them for tonight, but the Countess is going to be published in 1916 today, an anthology of reactions with the Limerick Writers Centre. Now to be able to read it down there, and it's quite a long poem, so thanks for sitting through it. Iron flowers, purple flowers, forsythia, daisies, valerian. Iron flowers, purple flowers, I am their gateway, a cornucopia's built, restitched, verdant. Iron flowers, purple flowers, cosmetically improved, an iron arch, purple flowers, stars, pretty for their leaving. This poem is called The Mending, and it's my last one. Cold foot, warm glove, skin caress, velvet foot clasp. Step once onto houses quavering backbone, wood step, rose blown quivering. Those tiles white and grey have taken in my blood. Blue black old blood, bloody old water and her descent. You only go under for the duration. Cold step onto spinal stair into the light blown dark. Rose blown cold blood, light blown. Spinal wood, a panic blood. for that.
Thank you, Christine. So our third guest this evening is Rosaline Crowley. Her first book of paintings and poems, Point of Connection, was published by Bradshaw Books here in Cork in April of this year. Rosaline has a Bachelor of Arts degree in English and Psychology from University College Cork, a Higher Diploma in Education Ireland, ALCM, Speech and Drama, and a Gold Medal for the Speaking of Verse and Prose from Lambda. Rosaline's Irish heritage inspires her love of water, trees and open spaces. She signs her paintings as Roscoe. Rosaline draws on her creative energy to paint and write poems, exploring a sense of self and a point of connection. She spends her time living in Carmel, is it Carmel?
Indiana.
Carmel, Indiana in the USA, and you all come to Cork. You can get her at Roscoe at at.net, which is a bit of a mouthful.
ATT.
Okay, big round of welcome for Rosaline Crowley.
Thank you so much, and I want to thank Paul Casey for inviting me and to everybody here that's here this evening supporting this wonderful event. The first reading I have here is a short article that it was a challenge to write about how I feel about 1916, and it's followed by a poem that I wrote specifically for this evening. So I'll start by telling you that I was born in Cork. In order to go back to the origin of my feeling about 1916, I need to explain that before I knew about 1916, I knew about Tomás McCurtain, Mayor of Cork, 1920. I knew he had died in a non-natural way. I did not understand about his part in Cork 1916 effort, nor the detail of his assassination in March of 1920. It seemed too much for an 11-year-old to understand, and so the sense of awe and something beyond my comprehension stayed with me. I was confused. Later, during my mid-teens, I learned of 1916 through formal education. It touched my core being. It was the first time that I understood that life was lost for an ideal, a cause. The background of the brutality and evil of the actual execution of the leaders of the 1916 Easter Rising is shocking to a young mind. It left me with a feeling of sadness and some mistrust of humanity. My young adult life feeling about 1916 came about when I learned about 1916 through poetry. Yeats and Padraic Pearse tried to make sense of 1916 through words. Words, especially words in poetic form, can help to create images that are beyond words. These images then create the feelings in the reader or the person receiving the communication. Through my reading of poetry, this feeling of 1916, for me, was not about right or wrong, political ambitions, or what didn't result. My feeling about 1916 taught me that I come from a people who are of strong character, and they have passed on a mentality and standing up for who you are and being prepared to be selfless if that is what it takes. I'm thankful that there were people who sacrificed their lives for the good of the whole society. Today, 1916 runs through my veins and is what makes me Irish. 1916 created a historical group identity that goes beyond words and boundaries. So the poem that I wrote for this evening, I called it, If You've Been to Ireland, You Know Who I Am. 1916 to 2016 sees a century of struggle in between. The pain inflicted on our community is deeper than you think. Nowadays,
Some find comfort in the imbued drink. Others rise up and improve the economy, while more defend justice and the right to be free. The oppression of the past lingers in our blood. Stories unfold, told, and untold. There is pain in the heart and pain in the soul for those who want the country to be whole. The future of our children will be bright. One for all for one without a fight. Sisters and brothers, mothers and fathers, no room for rhetoric and haters, best to love and be loved. No need to shove and be shoved. Raise up your glass and cheer. The identity of an island is here. Through sport, poetry, music and dance, the counties connect and entwine at a glance. More popular now than ever before, the people open the hospitality door. Hopefully, the sun will shine on an Easter day to open minds and hearts and the Irish way.
So it's mentioned that I have one life, but I lived in two different places. And so Indiana is about 3 hours south of Chicago, and it's very fortunate to live there in the sense of it has a wonderful arts community, and we have writers group there, and we have an arts community. So the thing about living in two different places is that you tend, when you're in one place, you seem to romanticize the other place and vice versa. Or, you have that duality, that split sense of self. So the first poem I'm going to read here that reflects that duality is when I'm sitting in a sunroom in my house in Carmel, Indiana, and I'm thinking about y'all. And how many people here have been to y'all recently?
I was there about a half an hour ago.
That's good. It's still there, isn't it?
All right.
That's great. Okay, so I call this poem The Soulful Beach. And so the title means that basically when I'm in my sunroom in Indiana, my soul is actually still in y'all in Ireland. And the beach is always in my head, the water, the sand, the sea, it's constant. So much so one time my father-in-law was in the a picture of him in the golf club, and I said, what's my painting doing next to him? And what it was is that it was the open window of the sky and the sea, and usually that's what I paint, is what I call an ecotones series. An ecotone is when two landscapes come together, or in that case for me it was sky and sea, and for me it also reflects two cultures coming together. Okay, so Soulful Beach. A daily dose of hope for future joy leads me where my senses are stirred. The sound of seagulls call out in repetitive rhyme, replacing cars and trucks that hammer past. Alone, surrounded by wicker chairs and fake flowers from plastic foliage stuffed in a cage, on top of a rug with leafy tufted stems, I travel to my world of peace and youth, where lost years are nothing but cerebral escape. Forever in my mind, sand, sea, and sky take form. Through the door to my soul, like a thread through a needle, I enter pointedly and confidently and reach my guided view of light. The title of the next poem, Best of Both Worlds, comes from when I was walking through the customs in Shannon, and you get asked, what were you doing in Ireland? Was it business or pleasure? How long did you stay? And when I explained that I have one life and two worlds, the lady said, you have the best of both worlds. Best of both worlds. Whether the sun shines or the wind blows, you'll find me on an airplane going home. Maybe you'll find me on a boat or a bus. Whatever the object of my transportation, I'm on my way.
Driven by love or fear of losing ties, my veins pumped and my heart is full. After soaking in the views and renewing senses, my mind returns, and then it's time to reverse the sojourn. Back again, my other home awaits. Two worlds exist, and I experience parallel lives. The hairdressers, the coffee shops, friends and family equally shape me. Except for sea and sand, my days are similar. Mirror images of self and self. My world is my world. So I'd like to continue that theme of the identity of being Irish and how that has really been the focus of my poetic life, at least, is focusing on, you know, who am I and what am I in both places. This poem reflects time that my great-grandparents lived in Inchigila. And so the land was passed on to my father, and then to my grandmother, to my father, to my mother, and then on to us five siblings. I reconnected with Inchigila. I don't know if anybody here knows Joe Creedon down there in the hotel, where he told me he paints and he writes poetry. And he was actually able to give me, you know, family stories. In fact, when I went in and he shared family stories, there were two men at the bar, and one man turns out to have been related to me and was able to give me my great-grandmother's maiden name, which I didn't know. So I wrote this poem in honor of Inchigila, and I call it Of Land and Poetry, Inchigila. Standing on a ditch overlooking lofty ranges, pursuing the same cragged hilltops my grandmother knew as a child, her son, my dad, sharing his gift of land and poetry, shouted, "Cast your eye from the top of the hill to the depth of the valley, as far as you can see." The vastness left an impression. The impression left a mark. The mark left an indelible memory. The memory found a voice. The voice found a pen. The pen found a paper. The paper came from a tree. The tree returned to the bog. The bog came home to me. This bog, high above the village, contains dead trees and crushed life. In contrast, the people from the village are alive with stories, song and laughter. Through words and images of familial ancestry, my story joins the recited stories. Over time, friendships take root and pass to another generation. In sterner days, there was no return. Presently, in good health, the travel is tough, the reward glorious, and the circle complete. I came home to the bog. I'll finish with two poems, that one carrying on from that. I talk about these two lives, but actually I can't give up either one of them. As you know, when you, some of you will know, if you move cultures, you move to another country, things don't stand still. So I have two grown-up sons and I have a granddaughter in the States. So for me, it's not a question of where I prefer or where I live. I have to live in the two places. So I actually, you know, have given up saying, which one do you prefer, when people ask me. It's not even a question. I have two places I live, and I continue to have my Irish identity in both. This poem is called The Bulging River. "Can you see the woods from the trees?" my father always asked. "Time flies, you cannot. They fly too fast." Another of his poetic pleas. I learned a lot from my dad. I like to shoot the breeze, go with the flow. I learned a lot from my dad. Latin words, Gaelic words, poems, and how to sing to the birds. Platycines are peeping through the gorse. Grass is greener on the other side. Bulging river, life's force. Too deep to jump this water divide. And I'll finish with a poem that I wrote, probably one of my first poems, but It really reflects for this evening for me the poets, the patriots, the visionaries, the dreamers who lived in the States and then returned to Ireland, you know, even before this, the 1916 or during or after 1916. It's called an exile song, and I'll finish on that. Thank you. It's been a while since ere I saw you. It's been a while since I was home. But don't you fear, because I love you. When I lay my head down, I know I'll be home again someday. It's been all of 7 years. It's taken all my innocent ways, but I can still see your colors. When I lay my head down, I know I'll be home again someday. It's been all of 17 years. It's taken all my blonde hair, but I can still hear your music. When I lay my head down, I know I'll be home again someday. It's been all of 27 years. It's taken all my breath away, but I can still smell your flowers. When I lay my head down, I know I'm home today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosalind. Thank you very much indeed. So the final part of the night is we're going to have two guests. So the first of those is Yamima Mita. Her life and background transcends many of India's religions and many of India's borders, including the most intractable one of Pakistan. Her mother comes from a Christian Hindu family of educationalists from Bengal, who were Gandhi's very first host in India, and her father from a political business Mumbai Muslim family. Involved in social justice issues, mother tongue education, theatre, Indian classical music and Indian cinema, she's been an activist and an educator, a student of music, and both acted and directed in theatre. She has worked on women and law, bonded workers and labour unions in Pakistan, runs Pakistan's only bilingual school. In Ireland, she's active in the Indian Classical Music Society of Ireland, married to an Irishman. Ireland is one of her homes, Patrick Pearce, one of her heroes, and both her children are Gael girls. She is the co-author of Pakistan, Tradition and Change, 1996, and translator of Obedience to the Emir, an early text on the Afghan Taliban movement in 2015. She'll be joined by Fiona Bolger, whose work has appeared in Southward, The Brown Critique, Poetry Bus, The Chattertube Review, and others. She performs in Estrogen Rising, a response to The Waking Feminist, 1916. She has appeared at The Monday Echo, Dub, Ovale, Lingo, and others. She is coordinator of Dublin's Writers Forum and a mentor with Uversity. So please welcome Fiona and Yamamia. Thank you.
So I'd like to start with a little something from my own childhood. When I first heard about 1916, it was all about my granduncle, Robert Brennan, who wasn't really my granduncle, he was married to my grandaunt, Una Brennan. And all I heard about him was how he fought in 1916, how his house was raided by the Black and Tans, how he was arrested, how he was held in Britain and Ireland, and how finally, when the Free State was founded, he was the first Irish legate to New York, well, to Washington, to America. I'd like to read you a little extract from one of his daughter's short stories. And this one is called The 12th Anniversary, and her name is Mae Brennan. She seemed to have no resources of her own. When she looked at him, he, Martin Baggett, might be described as having a wife and family in the background, but never around his neck. That's why he wanted time to think, so that he could free himself once and for all from the hateful self who behaved like a poor wretch with a wife and family around his neck. He detested the house when he felt like this, because he felt the house transformed him. When he was away from home, he was all right, and able to convince himself that Delia was all right. After all, she had the house and the children, and what more did she want? She had a life of her own. That is what he told himself. And Una, his wife, well, I never heard much about her. She lived through all of that. And he dedicated his book Allegiance to her, Una, a quiet, brave, and very patient lady, he said. When Mrs. Baggett had collected the flowers she wanted, she took them into the kitchen and began to arrange them in a small green bowl. Then she changed her mind. She went up to the dining room, to the glass-fronted cabinet there, and got a cut glass bowl, a treasure of hers. She took the bowl to the kitchen and started all over again, arranging the flowers quite differently. The glass bowl was particularly well suited to the flowers, and she carried it upstairs proudly and set it on the desk by Martin's window. He got home from work very late, long after they were all asleep, and he would be surprised when he put on the light and saw the flowers waiting for him there beside the books. She was used to his coming home late. He didn't want to disturb her or the children, and then he didn't want to be disturbed by them in the morning when they all got up. Then I discovered that Una, when she had left school, had actually joined Maud Gonne's Inneen an Héireann. She was also one of two women who were sworn into the Irish Republican Brotherhood at the behest of Robert. In 1915, she had joined Cumann na mBan, and in 1916, she had left her six-year-old daughter with her family in Oil Gate and had headed into Enniscorthy, and she was one of the women who climbed the Athenaeum to raise the Tricolour during the Rising. She was held in Waterford and in Mountjoy in jail in Dublin, and she was charged with armed rebellion. Her colleagues described her as a very forceful personality. She seemed to have no resources of her own. When she looked at him, the expression in her eyes put him on edge. He was always afraid she would say something that would bring the house down around his ears before he had time to decide what he was going to do. And now, on the morning of their anniversary, when she left the room after that significant hesitation, he had a sudden feeling of fondness for her and of gratitude that she had said nothing to make him feel uncomfortable. So out of all this, Robert Brennan, Una Brennan, Maeve Brennan, my family stories, I had a strange dream. I'd begun to keep my notebooks in the suitcase my father had from Maeve Brennan. He had been keeping it by his armchair after my uncle asked if he wanted it. Because he didn't, and why would he? The family had already burned her papers to be sure no bad light fell on Robert, the married-in, much-loved hero whom they all worshipped. And Una, well, she couldn't even get a pension from the Free State. And maybe the papers, now ashes, told more of her story. Or maybe not. But for now, the only words lying in that suitcase are all mine.
Reddy from South India. Kathleen Lynn is a woman who is almost forgotten in Ireland. Muthulakshmi Reddy is a well-known and well-loved name in South India. Both women fought for freedom of their lands. We will be using the 8 different avatars of the goddess Lakshmi to look at these two women's experiences.
We were born 10 years and continents apart, united by class, education, and a desire for the liberation and justice for women and children. Adi Lakshmi, the mother. My mother brought me visiting, helping the post-famine poor. Valuable lessons in poverty.
My mother warned me about her Devadasi past, wanted me married off as a young girl.
Danya Lakshmi Graham, I campaigned for midday meals. My hospital provided care for inner city children, jobs for the excluded women medics.
There were those children of a lesser god, hungry, abused and abandoned, who found refuge at Hawaii home, where beggars came for meals.
Santana Lakshmi, children and productivity. I left politics early, disappointed, but the babies dying in the slums kept the doctor and me working till I was 81.
I had plenty to give from what I had learned, and so I gave to orphan girls, fed well, trained for government teaching jobs, permanent with pensions.
Veera Lakshmi, courage. Under heavy fire, I crawled across roofs to rescue my commander. I took his place.
Schooled in medicine, I rescued abandoned women, fought child marriage, the killing of infant girls.
Gaja Lakshmi, elephant power and strength. I fought for Ireland with a gun at City Hall, for women with words in Sinn Féin. Disillusioned, I focused on health in St. Albans.
They labelled me anti-Brahman when I banned prostitution, but my cancer institute and Hawaii home still serve the people of Madras.
Vijaya Lakshmi, victory. The tenements are gone, but emergency accommodation, direct provision, leave children homeless.
First woman legislator in British India. I walked with Gandhi, my name on a postage stamp. A street in Madras, a Padma Bhushan. I was Vijaya.
Hana Lakshmi, wealth. With £70, I started St. Dalton's. It prospered. It led the fight against TB, the biggest killer of the time.
What I gained from a teacher, a father, a king, I gave to three women who came to my door and left, a doctor, a teacher, a nurse.
Vidya Lakshmi, wisdom. I learned to find ways around when the route was blocked, created spaces for women to flourish. I hope by now the power is shared.
Working with the vulnerable, feeling their fear, I walk the path of liberation for our country, our women, our children. And yet, women and children are suffering a dearth of luxuries. From liberation movements in each other's countries. But there seemed a special spark between the freedom fighters of Bengal and of Ireland. In 1916, Dan Gain became a well-known name, and his book, the name of which I can't find, it was widely translated into Hindi, Tamil, and Punjabi. And a lot of the young freedom fighters carried this book like a textbook in their pockets. Sorry?
Well, I think you know the name of the book. My Fight for Our Freedom.
That's probably it. A lot of young freedom fighters, when they were found, used to have fragments from this book in their pockets, and it was considered a textbook for young Bengali revolutionaries. Patrick Pearse became a hero to many revolutionaries from Bengal. And the Easter Rising was something that people in Bengal particularly and all over India felt very involved in. In the 1930s, a young group of students led by their teachers fought against the British in a movement that pitted the might of a few people, a few very, very young people, against the British Empire. It was the rebellion was at a place called Chittagong. The poem is written by Neeta Mishra. It's called IRA Chittagong Branch. And this is the Indian Republican Army, which is what they called themselves. The boys and girls of Chittagong marched to their freedom with dreams of free lands once more. Those teenage boys and girls and their master Da, inspired by the Irish Republican Army, they read the terrorist textbook, My Fight for Irish Freedom, those boys and girls of Chittagong. This band of teenage rebels on Easter Friday, 1930, inspired not by the Easter feast, but by a desire to resurrect the gem of young Ireland, Bierce. With their passion for rising they had memorized, they marched to their freedom. A mirror of 14 years earlier in another country, Sir John Anderson was in charge, the British Undersecretary then and now, the Governor of Bengal, armed with his Irish experience, and they with dreams of free lands once more. A handful of teachers, a band of 54 schoolboys and girls, land an attack on the mighty British Empire, land to disable their colonial service, the armory, the telegraph office, the railway lines, the European club, no dogs, no Indians allowed, not the boys of and girls of Chittagong. They were marching to freedom, they were succeeding, but then a traitor gave them away, colonial intelligence. Its violence, its heavy guns and rifles followed these youths to the jungles of Jalalabad. A bloody battle ensued, and one by one they fell to the tyranny of the British Empire. Brothers, sisters lay bloodied and dead in the ruins of a youthful dream gone wrong, with Dan Boone's fragments in their pockets and dreams of free lands dead in their hearts. In 1932, Preeti Lata attacked the club to avenge her friends. It shook the empire, but wounded, she took poison and died. In 1933, Master Da was arrested. They broke his teeth and bones, hung him unconscious, a dead body caged and drowned. They died before him, those boys and girls of Chittagong. Those boys and girls of Chittagong marched to their freedom with dreams of free lands with soon.
That all those wonderful images you've been looking at were put together by Lovisa Cosgrave, who's